Great. It's nice to be here. Thank you for coming. And this is a joint symposium with C4 and CA. And so for the first part, the introduction, I'd like to bring those two groups together. And I think I'd like to start this conversation with the centers of origin, or an idea of the centers of origin for crop species. What I put up here is for grain crops, but most of our crops originated from a place. And what I've circled are the areas of the centers of origin that were mapped out by our famous colleague and inspirer for the National Plant Germplasm System, Nikolai Vavilov. And he traveled throughout the world making collections. And his idea was that diversity of crops actually originate with the diversity in the origins of civilization. So that's my first point that I'd like to make, is that when we talk about crops and diversity, we're actually talking about domestication. And what does domestication look like? So I borrowed this slide from John Jobley. And he has worked on domestication of maize. But actually, there's a lot of general trends with domestication of many species. And if you look at it, many of these, if I can get my pointer right, are traits that are about the seeds. So when we talk about domestication, we're actually talking about seeds. And I'd like to add one more trait, because my talk is the next one, about, if it works, seed storage traits are also part of the domestication syndrome. And that shouldn't surprise you. When we were collecting, we as humans were collecting seeds, we really wanted them to hi. It's nice to see you. Someone in the audience from a long time ago. Anyways, the seed storage traits are, we want things to survive from harvest into the next time we plant. So it's not surprising that there are domestication traits. But the size of the trait, the loss of seed dormancy, we'll be hearing a lot about that. Ability to germinate, synchronized flowering. I believe that's part of a domestication trait, the phenology of materials. So, if humans are about domestication and agriculture, it's about traits and seed traits, and we need seed traits. In my lab, we can actually see domestication traits when we're working with diverse materials. It's not too hard to see when we're working with seeds that this idea of color and size is pervasive with all of the crops that we work with. So at the top, here's pistachio. It's not something that you usually think of as a crop, but on the right-hand side is the domesticated pistachio, and on the left-hand side is a darker, smaller seed. Same with coffee, often not thought of as a domesticated, or in terms of the seed crops, soybean, wild rice, for you, Remy. The cultivated wild rice is larger, and the wild progenitor, or at least a relic species, is smaller and darker. So seed color, seed size, coverings, these are things that are easy to actually see and to select for in domesticated in traits. Why were these so important? Well, because it's about nutrition, it's about taste. A dark color seed might have those phenolics that give it an acidy taste. Nutrition, pathogen resistance, handling, certainly if you have coverings that make it difficult to pack. These would all be things that our progenitors and early agriculturalists would be selecting for. And the argument that I want to make to you and to bring forward is that actually when we are selecting for seed traits, we're actually making an evaluation of a very profound part of the life cycle of seeds. In this, most often when we study plants, we're looking at the growth of the plant after it emerges from the soil. I'm going to tell you a little secret. When I was studying seed physiology for my PhD, Roger Spanswick taught quantitative plant physiology, and I said, I want to do a term paper on seeds. And his response is, I really would like you to do it on a real plant. And I think that idea many, many years ago has pervaded how we approach seeds, is that they're not really thought of as plants, but they are, and how they work through the reproduction, the reproductive biology through quiescence, and into germination is a profound part of why we are successful in agriculture. So the way I would look at it, if I were presenting seeds, and is into three phases. And within that, we have profound effects on what seeds would be doing. So in embryogenesis, we'd be looking at pollination and fecundity. Totipotency, that's totipotency is the ability to form any cell out of a single cell, and that's what embryos do, which is, well, let's continue, dry matter accumulation, acquisition of stress tolerance, and dispersal. These things are amazing that an embryo can do. That's why I fell in love with seeds in the first place, is that they can take it on the chin and still survive. And you will hardly see this kind of tolerance or this kind of ability to form new cells in any other material except in seeds. We move along to quiescence. These materials have amazing tolerance to stress. We can dry them completely. Zero, I'll talk about that in the next talk. And survive. They can survive without much problem in liquid nitrogen. I used to pop them in a microwave and see how long a seed could survive. So the stress tolerance is really quite remarkable. But also studies of dispersal and migration. And that's going to be very important when we start studying, or when we do study, invasive species. Profound effects on how our world is changing. Perception of time and environment. Seeds are natural clocks, and many times we don't think of it that way, that idea of marking time, and they have an ability to mark time. I'll be talking about it in my talk about in storage, but Dr. Cohn will be talking about marking of time in a dormancy-related issue as well. And, of course, defense against herbivores and pathogens. If you are sitting in the soil, you have virtually no defenses. So the ability to accumulate defenses are essential for survival of a seed. And finally, the transition between quiescence and germination and how that occurs. That's actually a profound method of going from completely dry to wet, and how that that transition into ametabolic to metabolic, the differentiation and switches, and eventually stand establishment. So, I think I'd like to present to you the case that these properties of seeds that are often taken for granted are actually a profound way of studying that are often not even approached in science. And we don't really think about seeds as forms, life forms that are the ability. Yet the plant probably has produced them for this amazing ability to survive, survive in the soil. So, don't leave at home without them. Looking back at the world, most of us have heard the literature that we're at a nexus between food security, water security, energy security. And that nexus has brought us to the idea that we need to start to conserve and steward our natural resources in a way that we have never really approached before as a species. I took this, I was at the Huntington Museum earlier this week, and I was just amazed. This is a Woodrow Wilson poster about hunger and how hunger is breeds madness. And I thought that this was a perfect way of introducing seeds and why they're so important and why genetic resources are important. Woodrow Wilson was using them to justify why we would do foreign aid after World War I. But we started really conserving resources in agriculture, starting at the Green Revolution. Not everybody shares that opinion, but I do think so in terms of how our land usage in the past, land usage was, if we wanted more production, we would put more land into use. But in the Green Revolution, there was a change in mentality. Instead of having more land to use, it was increasing the intensity of that land. And how do we do that? Well, this is some statistics from the World Bank for U.S. crop yields. And you can see from the early 60s to current, constant increase in the amount of grain per hectare. So that's what this intensity is happening. And it's been happening for, well, we're a success story in agriculture. How did they do that? Well, before we do that, I have some themes there, sorry. The location for it, if you notice, for the grain, and I'm presenting some data for wheat, is really very different from that center of origin. So the center of origin for wheat is that red, is the red circle in the Fertile Crescent area, and the green checks are the areas, the countries where with the highest productivity of wheat. And so the point is that we are in this together, and that this idea of diversity and the center of origin and the center of where those genetic resources are in a different area than where we're producing those crops. So I've already introduced the idea of genetic resources. That's how we've been able to increase our input. The way I look at genetic resources is the phenotypic diversity. And this is one of my favorite pictures of just looking at lettuce and all the diversity within lettuce and a common garden experiment. The idea here is that there is a sort of an attrition of genetic diversity, or you can say an expansion, depending on which way you're going, from the domesticated species, the named cultivars, into the non-economic wild. And if that's the case, then we probably would want to be concentrating with genetic diversity and genetic resources on our more wild relatives, our non-economic wild. But the potential for those is hidden, which requires more research in terms of what is valuable. And the risk for habitat also increases as you go to more wild. So it presents for us the idea of conservation. And I like to use the, well, it's easy for me to remember, why we conserve. And we can conserve for a lot of different reasons, and everyone has different reasons to conserve, but I call it four E's and an O. We conserve for an economic reason, and I've already sort of brought that to you with the economics of crops. We can also do it for an environmental reason, and that idea is taking land out of agriculture and producing intensifying its production so that we can use that land for conservation of our more wild. Ethics, I work a lot with conservation groups, and there's an ethic associated with conservation. It's a little bit harder to bring to an agronomic discussion, but I think it belongs there in terms of we as a species. Aesthetics, okay, a little bit bad spelling, but I think people naturally link to their plants, and the aesthetics of a beautiful plant has always been part of a conservation mandate. And finally, the opportunity. And I've discussed that already in terms of how we find hidden traits. Often it's the opportunity that we have that it's very difficult to know before we've conserved what it is that we're actually after. Four E's and an O, that's why we conserve. So, when I became permanent at NCGRP, the idea of conservation was at the top of my list of how do I justify this, especially because when I was working, there were a lot of people who were concerned about endangered species and the Endangered Species Act, and they thought that gene banking was actually counterproductive to their conservation needs. That certainly has changed over the last two decades, but I want to present that. So this paper is one of the ones that has affected me way back then and continues to affect me in terms of how we think about gene banking. What Michael Soulet presented was how we conserve as human beings, with political instability on the x-axis and the amount of technology on the y-axis. And what the red is an interesting concept, that those places that are more politically stable and higher technology have less of a conservation need than countries that are much more unstable and don't have technology either. That's kind of a double whammy. In those days, they were looking at more of the in situ conservation. So the restoration projects were a large part of a conservation strategy. But you can notice up in the upper hand corner, those are the gene banks. That's what I work for, and proud to do so. The zoo parks and the botanic gardens as well. These are ex situ conservation strategies that require a certain amount of technology, and usually you see them in politically stable areas. So going further with that, Soulet looked at all the different conservation strategies. Those are across the top. And also presented this idea of conservation target. What is it that you're trying to conserve? And he looked at it in different levels, ecosystem level, that's big conservation, all the way down to genetic variation. And I want to point out that he also had this idea of species in there, but here's this genetic variation. It's an interesting table that he presented. The triple X's are how effective you would be, and the zeros would be completely ineffective. And what he predicted would be happening is that in situ would be your most effective no matter what, and that the gene banks, which are on the far side, I should probably show you that, the field collections, the botanic gardens, would be the living ex situ. The gene banks would be the ex situ suspended because they're not growing. What he predicted that gene banks would be very, very good at storing corn and soybeans, and they are, but not so effective at the non-economic. And in general, this idea is that we really want to go for in situ rather than ex situ. So, that's not obviously not what happened 20 years ago. And in fact, we do have some gene banks, and I'd like to present ours, and you can see that there's lots of similarities between them, at least architecturally. But even over the course of that, there have been a lot of gene banks that have come into existence. And right now, there are about 1,300 plant gene banks in the world, and about 6 million accessions. If you figure an accession is about 1,000 to 5,000 seeds, you're talking about a lot of individuals that we've been able to preserve that way. I should have put my punchline at the beginning, right? So, we do have gene banks. Obviously, somebody and the world thinks that this is something that's worth doing, probably because we are using our technology effectively. So, fifth and last thought. First of all, preserving corn is not so hard. It's very uniform. It's very well characterized. You can get the seeds for it. It's not so, in the scheme of things, it's not so hard. And I use these as model systems, domesticated species and domesticated accessions, to answer some hard questions. But it's not so hard. When we start going into the wilds, we actually are going into an increased complexity for seed traits. Just those very traits that I talked about at the beginning, the maturity, the handling, the storage, the quality. These are complex traits. Susanna will be telling us more about complex traits. And so as soon as you start going into gene banking for the wild germplasm, you begin to have much more complexity and harder management tools for them. And the utilization also becomes a little bit more challenging. I think we're up to it. You got to invest in some seed science, and we can do it. So I've worked a lot with endangered species. Just getting the seeds is hard. It's very costly. So there's going to be investment in that. And the seeds vary in maturity. All these traits that we take for granted in the domesticate vary now in the wild. And so you can actually appreciate what agriculture and domestication has done for plants. And I think we will hear a lot today about the unknown germination requirements. How do you get these things to store? Which is the big part of germplasm storage, is to be able to use them. So my thesis for this talk is that in order to conserve materials, we have to be able to understand seeds. And to move forward, we've got the gene banks, and now we have to use the material in a responsible way, in a careful way. And so I use the wise words from conservation. We will conserve only what we love. We will love only what we understand, and we will understand only what we are taught. Go seed science. So, with that, I will hand it back to Susanna.